I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Peter Brimlow. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Greg.
Today, we are going to discuss a book by Quinn Slobodian. Quinn Slobodian is a Canadian academic. Quinn is a very Irish-sounding first name, and Slobodian apparently is a Ukrainian surname. He is a professor at Boston University, professor of history. And he's written three books that I have now read. One is called Globalists, which was published in 2018 by Harvard University Press. And it's substantially about the Austrian School of Economics, which was a big surprise to me. The second book, which was published by Alan Lane in the UK in 2023, is called Crack Up Capitalism, basically attempts to create free market zones, enterprise zones, things like that around the world. And the libertarian type people who back that up. So again, it's an extension of his interest focally on libertarianism. And then he brought out this book called Hayek's Bastards. And the subtitle is The Neoliberal Roots of the Populist Right. And it came out last year from Alan Lane again in the UK. And it has five chapters, and chapter three, which is the longest, substantially focuses on Peter Brimlow. And I thought, well, I'd like to get a sense of how accurate this history is. And so who better to ask than one of the people who's discussed at great length in the book? Because the Slobodian book is an odd book, but it's very interesting because the way I read it is that it's sort of the prehistory of something that around 2015, we started talking about as the libertarian to alt-right pipeline. When he talks about neoliberalism and the populist right, he's talking about the same kind of transformation, intellectual transformation. And by neoliberal, he doesn't mean what people normally mean by neoliberal. He means free market economics. Whereas neoliberalism, the way I understood it, was sort of Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. Is that how you basically understand neoliberalism?
I completely agree, Greg. I always think of it somebody like Michael Kinsley, who were part of the movement, as you say, with Bill Clinton to reclaim the Democrats from left-wing craziness, at least make it moderately, disguise the craziness with some acceptance of markets and things. So I find his Slobodian's use of this term really bizarre and irritating. By the way, I would have thought Slobodian was an Armenian name.
No, it's I looked at the EN does sound Armenian, definitely, but I looked it up and apparently it is a Ukrainian surname, but it could be a Ukrainian surname with distant Armenian roots for all we know.
Well, you're probably right. I'm sure it's right because he was born in Edmonton, and on the prairies, in Canada, there is a substantial settlement of Armenians.
Mm-hmm. So you've read this book. What was your reaction to it? Did you recognize your portrait in it?
Frankly, the answer is yes. I mean, he's shown it's a very, very weird book. And he's shown almost a maniacal determination. He's read enormous numbers of things that I've written. I personally have written, going back to the columns I used to write for the Financial Post in the 1970s when I lived in Canada. You know, Richard Hofstadter had this concept of paranoid scholarship, and he used to say that the people like the Birches and so on were paranoid, used to involve themselves in paranoid scholarship. And that's what this is really. I mean, he piles up enormous amount of detailed information about what I and others have said over the years. The funny thing about it is that, you know, it's like a giant with a pea brain. He's done all this tremendous work on digging at what people say, but there's almost no analysis. And that's because if you read it very carefully, you realize that he just thinks that saying, well, so-and-so was interested in racial differences and read the bell curve and so on. That to him, that's damning in itself. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to argue with it, and I guess there's a whole species of leftists. He's got excellent reviews all over the establishment media, And as you know, it was published first in the US actually, but then it was published in England. This is a book which can't have much of a market internationally, but he did a book tour in England. So somebody's put a lot of money behind this book.
I think that he is some species of Marxist. And when I first started reading this, the analysis struck me as, well, this is a version of the old-fashioned Marxist analysis of fascism, that fascism is basically petite bourgeois dictatorship to try and stave off the proletariat. And there is a very strong paranoid style to Marxist scholarship. And because he's Marxist, I think that it's enough for him to simply say these people were at this conference talking about these topics and also these topics. And for him, that's an organic enough unity to skate by. Whereas for me, being a philosopher, I look at this and I think, well, what's going on here? When you get people who start out as doctrinaire classical liberals, as sort of abstract rights-based classical liberals, and then over time they become racial nationalists. How is that possible? How is it possible to become a, in effect, a collectivist from being an individualist? That's an intellectual journey, and he doesn't seem to need to deal with the logic of that. How did these premises lead to these conclusions? What's going on here? Because it's enough for him to just establish that people were in the same room together and the Volcker Fund was funding them and the Mount Pelerin Society was talking about this. And that's enough. It's not enough. But what I found was really interesting about the book was not the analysis, but just the assembly of data. I went down this libertarian to alt-right pipeline. I went down it before the term alt-right was coined, long before. I started out in high school. I read Free to Choose and Ayn Rand's Anthem in high school. I read Atlas Shrugged and Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, and Henry Hazlitt my first year of college. By my second year of college, I was tackling human action and socialism in the same quarter, and not coming out much and coming up for air because there were such big books. But I was really into this. And then I got into Hayek after that. I was interested in economics, but also political theory. But I got more and more interested in the philosophy of the human sciences. And Hayek was the guy who got me into this stuff. And throughout the 90s, I was keeping an eye on the libertarian world, the Austrian economics world, and I was noticing things going on in that world, such as the discussion in 1994, I believe, of the bell curve. Earlier than that, there was a discussion of the Balkan Wars, and people like Murray Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe were talking about how maybe ethnically homogeneous states are more functional than multi-ethnic states like the former Yugoslavia. I saw David Duke become a big thing and anti-affirmative action become a big thing. And I saw libertarians co-opting that kind of stuff. I saw,
Some libertarians.
some libertarians. I saw the paleo-libertarian turn. I became aware of the John Randolph Society. I started reading Chronicles magazine. And there was a lot of discussion of things that were not permissible if you were a pure moral and methodological individualist, a pure classical liberal. Things like nation states, things like race and IQ,
Families,
that
of
kind of,
course.
families, all of these things that were conservative sounding things or nationalist sounding things, but they were in the conversation. And there were libertarian figures of great stature, like Rothbard, who were flirting with all this stuff. So I was watching all this. And for some reason, I still felt like I was an outsider for thinking the same things that all these other people were thinking. And it was kind of funny. And so when I read this book, I realized, all these people that I was following at the time were actually making the same journey that I was making. and yet I felt like I was on the outs with classical liberals, but a lot of people in that milieu were on the outs with classical liberalism. And what he does in this book is he goes back to the early 70s, actually, and makes some references to even earlier events, where within the context of these groups like the Mont Pelerin Society, there were discussions of race realism and human biology. And so I found that really fascinating. And then he seems to treat, though, your career and the creation of Alien Nation, which was published in 1995, is sort of where this new synthesis comes together most clearly. At least that's why I believe he spends so much time on it right in the middle of the book.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? He actually has somewhere a reference to a column I wrote in for the old Financial Post in Canada in 1978, in which I was fantasizing about the future. And I said that the great conservative editor in Canada, Peter Worthington, will be leading a guerrilla band to attack an independent Kazakhstan. And he takes this absolutely seriously. He thinks it's actually proposing mm-hmm. to invade the Soviet Union. But what strikes me about it is, you know, at that point in 1978, you're too young to remember it, Greg, but nobody had the least idea that the Soviet Union was going to break up. So it mm-hmm. was a joke. So, but he is digging around there in the 70s. That's perfectly true. I think one of the things about this book is, in some ways, it conflates the whole paleo-libertarian and pale-conservative moment in the early 90s with the alt-right, you know, basically 20 years later. That's kind of a mistake. Rothbard was a considerable intellectual entrepreneur and also a dedicated mischief maker. But he mm-hmm. decided to break with establishment libertarians, which we called the Koch Trusts because of the funding by the Koch brothers, and outflank them on the right. And he wanted to form an alliance between the right and libertarians, and that's why he developed this pale libertarian concept. And the pale conservatives and the pale libertarians, that you're right, they're a meeting point with the John Randolph Society. But what he doesn't say is that after Rothbard died in the middle 90s, this broke up because mm-hmm. The pale libertarians, well, basically, I'm afraid it was the personality clashes. Without Rothbard to hold them together, Tom Fleming at Chronicles and Lou Rockwell at the Mises Institute just quarreled. They're both very quarrelsome individuals, Fleming being extraordinarily quarrelsome, being intellectuals, they rationalized this breakup in intellectual terms. And that was a terrible thing, that the movement broke up. And it took another 20 years to put it together as the alt-right. It's hard to remember now, but we really did think in 1992, when Pat was running against George Bush and did so well in the primaries in New Hampshire, that we were on the verge of a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was completely crushed by the established media and relentless harassment of one time or another, and the movement broke up. But it really was proto alt-right, really. And mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to know that they broke up and quarreled with each other, which is kind of odd given his voluminous scholarship in other areas. One thing I didn't know, which I was interested to see documented so well in this book, is that von Mises himself had second thoughts about open borders and immigration. I was dimly aware of this, but he actually did all the work way back in the beginning of the Second World War on this subject. Mm-hmm.
And he was also a race realist, too, which I found really remarkable. I had no recollection of that at all. And I might not have actually read any of those statements. But I thought that was kind of remarkable. He was very candid about these things. That's another thing that I thought was very interesting about people like Mises and people like Hayek and also Milton Friedman, who you interview, and the interview in here, one of the interviews that you did is quoted in here.
Yes.
And it's actually kind of central. And the astonishing candor of somebody like Friedman saying, well, maybe capitalism only works with, say, Anglo-Saxon cultures.
I was astonished that you would say that, because you thought him as being a fire-breathing libertarian, but actually he wasn't. He thought a lot about cultural issues, Friedman. Mm-hmm. He was quite a remarkable figure.
Yeah, I thought that was remarkable. So there were these figures who were involved with classical liberalism and free market economics, but they were not so doctrinaire that they wouldn't talk about these sorts of issues. Whereas today's academic ultra-leftist egalitarians are so doctrinaire that they simply repeat these ridiculous mantras like biological race differences are discredited, race is a social construct, all this nonsense. And you find people like Mises, people like Hayek, many of the figures in their circles are having conferences where they're talking about the importance of biological distinction. And one of the chapters in here is actually called, I believe, The Rock of Biology. And I found it really quite fascinating because there were discussions of this in the early 70s, but it was really after the fall of communism that some people who were anti-communist and pro-capitalist in a broad sense, including people who are not, say, doctrinaire libertarians, but they believed in the marketplace. These people were looking around and they were seeing that their major enemy, which seemed to have collapsed, was mutating into different forms, radical feminism, the ecological movement, stuff like that. And they started talking about things like biological race differences. There was actually a conference in the Galapagos Islands, which struck me as rather amazing because that was one of the most important places where Darwin formulated a lot of his ideas. And you had these free market types going off to the Galapagos Islands to listen to lectures by people like Charles Murray, who was about to bring out, or maybe had just brought out, the bell curve. I found that all very remarkable because it seemed to be the case that as when communism fell, people got a deeper insight into what the enemy was. It wasn't just communism, it was radical egalitarianism. And a lot of people believe that the rock that would sink that ship was going to be the rock of biological race differences.
I mean, Slobodin actually cites an article I wrote for Forbes just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and where I said, if socialism is dead, why won't it lie down? And my conclusion was that the left is simply, without breaking step, moved from the efficiency arguments for socialism, which that people generally did think that socialism was more efficient than capitalism, less wasteful, and so on. I don't know if you've ever come across anybody who thinks that, but I used to meet them in the 50s and the early 60s. I mean, that in fact, it was taken for granted to consider it to a large extent. Anyway, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that argument became rather more difficult to make. So they seamlessly moved to equity. You have to move. We have to intervene in the society to promote social justice, and also, of course, climate justice and all this kind of thing. They did it absolutely seamlessly, and the editor of Forbes put the headline on, socialism with a red face or a green face. There was a period in the middle 90s which John Derbysh and I called the interglacial between the collapse of communism and I guess basically the reaction to the bell curve in by the late 90s, where people actually did discuss things, where things were allowed to be discussed, including, of course, immigration. That's when I brought up my immigration book. And it was not immediately anathematized. It took them quite a little while to get their act together, to anathematize it. And, of course, then ultimately had to anathematize me.
If I recall correctly, the early American Renaissance conferences were televised by C-SPAN.
Right, and quite notable people like Ann Coulter and so on attended. By the end of the 90s, they had completely suppressed the immigration debate, for example, which is my primary interest, of course. That you just weren't allowed to discuss it at all in the mainstream media. We have to distinguish. Murray was right that there is this phenomenon of the cult of course. There is an establishment of Luteranism, and a lot of people follow it. And they really are. They're actually the same kind of personality types as the student Marxists I met in university in the 1960s. They're just extremely dogmatic and extremely intolerant. By far the most difficult time I had making my immigration arguments in the 1990s were with libertarians. They would use left-wing arguments like this is just racism and all that kind of thing. against it. There's a really dogmatic personality type associated with the particularly establishment libertarianism. Because it provides an answer to everything, or they think. So it just has to be bashed into it. You just have to bash something hard enough to make it fit the mold. Okay. What I did, and if I think about it carefully, I mean, frankly, he says, for example, that Julian Simon, the economist, was my major antagonist, and that the Alien Nation, my book, was a book length argument with him. And there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, I went into his arguments, and he says I took his analysis and stood it on its head and came to the opposite conclusion. And that's essentially right. And I also point out that there were various things, there were various inconsistencies in what Simon said that people didn't pick up on. For example, he was not in favor of open borders. And he did agree that in his sort of huge dung heap of a book on immigration, it's just a pile of sort of perceptions and stuff. It's very weird, a very disorganized book. But he did say that he admitted that unskilled immigration is a net negative. He just felt it would become a positive in the longer run. But he was nowhere near as dogmatic about, or at least he hadn't conclusively made it systematic about it as the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which has a lot to answer for, the editorial page. I mean, it's misled three generations of businessmen on the value of immigration.
Who was it? Do you know the name of the person who said that America needs a constitutional amendment that with five words, there shall be open borders?
Gordon Crovitz, Krovitz, who's a very nice guy, by the way. I've not seen him for years, of course, but then I'm not socialized any of these people for years. Gordon Crovitz, he was thought to be going to be Bob Bartlett's successor, but did that. But for some reason, that didn't work out. Bob continued to run that editorial, and when we controlled National Review from about 88 to about 98, I used to write if they missed it, and after. After my immigration article cover story came out in 92, which became my immigration book in 95, we used to regularly wait for them to run this damn thing and ridicule them. And eventually they stopped running it. But I think they put it in again in the, after National Review was purged.
So one of the figures who's mentioned as, if not an influence, as one of your sort of foils for formulating your ideas was Peter Bauer. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think he somewhat exaggerates the role that sort of, for sort of a narrative purpose of the people, some of the people I talked to. He said I was very influenced by three people, but Bauer was a very formidable figure. And he did provide me with what I regard as one of the key insights in my economic analysis in Alienation. Alienation was fundamentally a book about economics. It was an argument with free market economists and libertarians. They would always say that immigration was necessary for economic growth. And Bauer pointed out to me that, and he cited the source, I believe it was Kuznets, he said that the literature of economic growth shows that increase in labor and increase in capital together can't account for growth. What accounts for economic growth is a third factor, which he called technology. It's just organization of ideas, organization, the organization of production is far more important than gross inputs. Because what that means is you can't make an economy grow just or at least not in any sustainable way by just injecting vast numbers of immigrants into it, least of all unskilled immigrants. So that was settled really intellectually. I mean, I made that argument in the mid-90s to absolutely no effect, because we see all around the Western world now. I mean, after Brexit, Boris Johnson was apparently persuaded that allowing thousands of Indians in was going to produce economic growth. And the same thing in Canada. Apparently the Canadian Liberals seriously thought under Trudeau that by vastly increasing the influx of Indians and Asians generally, they were going to turn Canada into an economic powerhouse, whereas in fact, of course, it's ruined it. So their per capita GDP has fallen very dramatically. Now, of course, they didn't really think this. The immigration policy in the Western world are run by people who hate the Western world and want to transform it, and the economic arguments are just a rationale. But this is a rationale that people take seriously, at least pretend to take seriously.
So when they talk about immigration increasing or driving economic growth, are they simply talking about cost cutting as a way of raising productivity?
Yeah, I mean the impact of immigration. The technical literature has been clear, for 30 years since I was researching alienation. If you get an influx of immigration, it will re-raise overall GDP, although not as much as people think. But the benefits of the GDP are entirely captured by the immigrants themselves. It doesn't benefit the native born at all. And that's been the consensus among labor economists for more than 30 years. It just hasn't penetrated the public debate. What it does do, however, is it causes a massive redistribution of income between labor and capital. At the time I wrote Alienation, it was something like 2 to 3% of GDP was being transferred from labor to capital. And that's why wages were stagnating. It does drive down wages. In fact, that's actually the only way in which you can show it reduces costs. But even people like Alan Greenspan and so on would repeat this idea that we can control inflation by driving down, by bringing in immigrants and breaking down the wage levels. Although, in fact, we know that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. It's got nothing to do with gross imports of resources.
It's astonishing to me how many people who should know that, like somebody like Alan Greenspan, simply equates rising prices with inflation.
Right, it's extraordinary. And as I say, I really do think. I mean, it's years since I read them closely, but I really do think the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal have a malign influence across the entire world, because they have sort of ordinary lumpen businessmen believing this stuff. I had an experience a few years ago, and I was in a debate at the Hudson Institute with a woman whose name I forget, yet another Jewish libertarian and economist. And she produced a guy who was joining the wars over in Arizona over their attempt to get control of to enforce immigration law during Obama, the Obama administration, which was substantially sabotaged by the Supreme Court. In any case, she produced a restaurateur from Arizona, who testified to the fact that without illegal immigrants, he would have to close the restaurant. He had a chain of them, and so I got when I got up, I got cross-examined him, and I said, "Now, these immigrants that illegal immigrants you've got in here, do they have families?" "Oh yes, they all have families." And do their children go? Are they in school and everything?" "Oh yes, they're all in school." "And do you pay for it?" And there was like a 10-second silence. He said, "Well, I pay through it for my taxes." And I said, "Well, look, per capita spending on education is something like $10,000 to $15,000 at that point in the US. So are you paying $15,000 into the school system for every immigrant child you've imported into your city in Arizona?" Of course, he wasn't. He had absolutely nothing to say. He had no idea. It was completely dumbfounded by this question. But the more interesting point is that this Jewish economist was Hudson then. She it not occurred to her that anybody asked this question either. So even people were supposedly trained in economics just don't think about these questions, the implication of transfer costs and so on.
My impression is that Republicans in general at the grassroots, there is no constituency for Wall Street journalism anymore. Everybody knows this has been suicide of the GOP and deeply skeptical about the economic argument. But it sure hasn't penetrated Congress yet.
No, not yet. One thing that I found interesting about Slobodian's discussion of your work is you talk about who's benefiting from open borders. And you bring in the professional managerial class idea as the people who are, well, it's not just managers, it's business
The new
people
class. It's
too.
the new class. It's
The
the
new
new
class,
class.
yeah.
Which includes, of course, bureaucrats and all kinds of hangers-on and so on, and quango NGOs and all this kind of thing. And they do benefit from it. The people who run the refugee rackets, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Association and the Catholic Charities and all this kind of thing. There were very, very substantial transfers of money to them.
So, folks, if you have questions about this book, if you've actually read it, or you're interested in things connected with this broader topic, or you just want to ask Peter some questions in general, you can do that. And we would most appreciate it if you do it with a paid super chat. You can go to Entropy. The address is across the bottom of the screen. Take out your credit card, send us a super chat. It's very helpful for keeping the lights on at Countercurrents. And we will definitely go through any of your questions in the course of today's discussion. I have a couple of questions already. One question is just about some of the people that are players in this book. And I'm just curious, can you tell me, did you know Murray Rothbard? Did you ever meet him or correspond with him?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I wrote about him for Forbes, as a matter of fact, at one point. Mm-hmm. And I remember having lunch with him once, and he'd just come back from a meeting, which was the organizing group. I think it was for, it might have been for American Renaissance, but it may have been something associated with Bill Regnery. And it was attended by Rabbi Schiller, who was a very interesting figure. He's a Hasidic rabbi who operates out of New Square in New York State. And has this whole group there, but he's extremely interested in right-wing ideas, and he always showed up at all these conferences. And Murray said to me, I mean, this thing isn't going to work. I mean, how many neo-Nazi Hasidic rabbis are there?
That's funny.
He was extremely witty, amusing character with very wide. And I mean, one thing is extremists in Gothic cathedrals, and you know, he used to go around Europe looking at Gothic cathedrals. And I think his views were actually even more radical than he let on. But he was able to hold the pale libertarian, pale conservative coalition together just through force of personality. He just had his 100th. I think we just had the 100th anniversary of his birth. He died tragically young in his early 60s.
What about Hans Hermann Hoppe?
Yeah. I just had an exchange with Hans recently, and I learned to my variegated interest that apparently there's some kind of a faction fight going on in the Mises Institute, and which he's been associated with for many years, he's having an argument with some of the people there. I went to the Property and Freedom Society conference, which is the conference he set up, which is the last remaining pale libertarian institution. He holds it. He still does hold it. He married a Turkish woman who, among other things, owned a hotel in Bodrum, Turkey, which is the old Halicarnassus. And he had this wonderful conference there every year. And I've spoken at it, and various other reprobates, Jared Taylor and Richard Spencer spoke there when he was in his alternative right phase. It was a great deal. It was a really remarkable conference. I think he's had to tone it down a bit because the Turkish authorities began to get nervous about it. But he, for example, he used to have Richard Lynn come, the great psychometrician, speak every year about race and IQ, and he was willing to have distance of all time speak there.
Did you ever meet Friedrich Hayek?
Yes, I did. I'm ashamed to say that I was sort of commissioned by the Fraser Institute, the Institute for Economic Affairs cloned itself around the world, and the Fraser Institute was one of them. Manhattan Institute in New York was another, and they commissioned me to do an interview with him, so I met him in Chicago and interviewed him briefly, but for various reasons I was never able to write it up. But I spent like a couple of hours with him we went over a number of interesting things. I remember him, he said to me, I was discussing how long it would take, he was against affirmative action, how long would it take the American blacks to catch up with American whites without affirmative action, artificially boosting their incomes. And he said, 400 years.
That's funny. My standard answer is 100,000 years of rigorous selection in an Arctic climate. But that's more in the Richard Lynn vein, I think.
Absolutely.
So that's interesting. Tell me your impressions of Hayek, and were you influenced by him? Are you one of Hayek's bastards, as the title would have it?
You know, Greg, as you know, I grew up in England, and I was in university from 67 through 70. Libertarians was as far as we were aware, almost completely extinct. I didn't really have any exposure to libertarian ideas until I was at the business school at Stanford. And of course, you don't actually exposure to any ideas in business school. It's just things I picked up from other students and so on. So I don't know that I was directly influenced. It was sort of an emanation of a penumbra or whatever the Supreme Court said about abortion. To the extent that I read Hayek and von Mises, it was quite a lot later than you did. I would have been in my late 20s or early 30s. And of course, I was already then a columnist at the Financial Post. So I guess I somehow picked these ideas up without learning them formally in any academic setting. But, you know, it was obvious, if you looked around and thought about it, that the whole socialist worldview was fundamentally flawed. And it was extremely strong, at least in England, but also actually indirectly in America, where it was called liberalism, in the 1950s and 1960s. I mean, the socialist government in England under Harold Wilson actually did intend to get control of the economy and manipulate it, and they really thought they could you know, outguess the market, and that was universally assumed. And then, of course, it was universally assumed that price and wage controls were the answer to inflation, which of course actually is socialism. You abolish the price system, and that happened in the U.S. too under Nixon, of all people. You know, there was serious the extent to which socialist ideas have penetrated public debate. It's easy to forget now. So we really were, as Slobodian sort of sneeringly quotes me as saying, we really, really, really were an embattled minority if we pointed out elementary flaws with this. I remember when I was at an economics tutorial at the University of Sussex with a guy called Donald Winch, who was an Anglo-American Keynesian. He was English, but he spent a lot of time, he taught at Princeton. And I was reading, our textbook was Samuelson, and which was an American textbook. And it made a reference to the quantity theory of money. And I said, I got interested. Now, this was not on the reading list, these sections. But in England, they don't, in those days, do what American universities do, which is specify, you know, read such a book from page 100 to 110, that kind of thing. We're given the book and told to read it. So it meant very inconveniently for the academics that we come up with all kinds of deviant ideas. So I said to him, what is this quantity theory of money? And he said, oh, it's not, just don't pay attention to it. Well, what's this rationale? I said, he said, it doesn't have a rationale. He's talking about Milton Friedman there. He's talking about monetarism has no rationale. Just completely ignored it. That would have been in about 1968. We're going right into the great inflation then.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do find annoying about the consensus in the sort of alt-right today or racial nationalist right is that they're very dismissive of the conservative movement. And they will say, these people have never won any battles. And
what about the damn Cold War? I mean,
there's the Cold War. And before that, there was the battle over socialism.
Right.
And it's astonishing how hegemonic these leftist ideas were. When you had Richard Nixon imposing wage and price controls, that really says it all. Richard Nixon abolishing the gold standard, things like that. And from that null point in the early 70s, they fought for 20 years and they built institutions going back decades earlier, but they fought for 20 some years and managed to create what people now call neoliberalism, and neoliberalism is basically the establishment left's surrender of socialism. And it's funny because even ultra-libtards like Bill Clinton or Joe Biden, if you ask them about socialism, oh, I'm a capitalist, I believe in free markets, they would actually do that. They wouldn't even say that sheepishly. Which I thought was really quite remarkable. That's a 20-25 year sea change that represents an extraordinary victory intellectually and politically.
Yes, that's right. I completely agree. I mean, it's hard to overestimate. It's impossible to overestimate how astonished people were by the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Which fundamentally was an economic collapse. I mean, it just could not make its system work. And yet, I actually keep meaning to get. I still have my Samuelson textbook. I keep meaning to photograph this page. I mean, right there in Samuelson, there were two charts of economic growth. I think it's one chart that charts economic growth in the Soviet Union and the U.S. And it shows the Soviet Union catching up with the U.S. Samuelson said, and he's a Nobel Prize winner. He said it's a vulgar error to suppose that a command economy can't work, but it didn't work. And you know, it's really a really remarkable thing. Of course, where it does work is and Friedman, in my interviews with Friedman, which are all VDare.com is still online, the website which I was forced to close by this black bitch in New York State lawfare from Letitia James. It's still online. You can search it all. All the Friedman interviews are up there. One of the things he said was where are you looking at government enterprise? Something that is by of its necessity controlled by the government, like the military, they can compete with the US. They just have to drain the rest of the economy of resources and throw it in, but they can build a functioning army, and they did build a functioning army. It's a question of how long they can keep it going if they can't extract resources from the rest of the economy. I mean, they did launch Sputnik, they beat the Americans into space. So it's not that it's not dangerous. It's just that it didn't work, and its death throes were very dangerous. Do you even remember the Cold War? How old were you when the Soviet Union collapsed, 1990, 1991?
Well, fairly young, but I was reading Milton Friedman in high school and things like that. So I was
Oh,
very
goodness.
much a believer in fighting against communism and that kind of stuff. So I paid attention to this, and I knew that all the quote unquote smart people believed this was going to be around for a long, long time. And I was very satisfied to watch this all unravel. It was quite fascinating.
It's
So
hilarious, isn't it?
I remember when Ceausescu and his wife were shot. I thought, wow, what a wonderful Christmas present. This is the world is really changing. A high tide of evil seemed to be ebbing away, and all kinds of new things started happening at that point. I remember Fukuyama and his triumphalism, and I wasn't caught up in that, but I found all of those debates intensely interesting.
Of course, so a name to be conjured with. I don't know that he actually mentions him. Let me just check. It's Pat Buchanan,
Yeah,
because
Buchanan's all over the book too. And I wanted to ask you if you knew
fifty
Buchanan.
results. Oh yes. What I was going to say was Pat, after he left the first Bush administration, he wrote an essay in Newsweek of all places, which I really have to get my hands on. But what he said was, we now have to think about new problems, and one of them was foreign policy. Do we actually need to have this alliance, anti-Soviet alliance in Europe now that the Soviet Union's gone? Another one was immigration. I mean, it's then clear that the 65 Immigration Act had set the US on also the disastrous course demographically. Shouldn't something be done about that? And of course, he was totally ignored. I mean, he tried to raise these issues in his campaigns in 92 and 96 and 2000, but the conservative establishment just completely squashed him. And nothing we could do, we just couldn't break through. Of course, I blame Bill Buckley, as I do for most things, for stabbing him in the back on this anti-Semitism question.
Absolutely. Yeah, you did know Buckley. Here's a meta question. Peter, are you going to write a memoir? Because I'd love to read a memoir.
Well, Greg, when we talked about the war on Christmas, the Christmas before last, you raised this and you advised me to get onto Substack, and that's what decided me to get onto Substack, where I now flourish under the name peterbrimlow.com. And so, and that has actually been a great consolation to me in this disastrous legal situation we've got with New York State, and the fact that I've been, pretty well exterminated. My voice is still there in some shape. So maybe I'll take your advice on that too.
Oh, I would love that because I do think well, it's history. You were part of history. You've got this Slobodian guy who's writing you into this historical narrative.
Well, you must tell Lydia that, because that's what she thinks too. But the problem is, of course, nobody's going to pay me to do it either, Greg.
Well, you
I
it's
don't see
content for
Random
your
House or
Substack.
HarperCollins. I'm sorry?
Yeah. It's content for your Substack, though,
Right,
and I think that would be
exactly.
great.
One of the curious things about Slobodian is, you know, he's been sort of messing around, hanging around for quite some time. And I've been seeing some of this book he wrote a couple of academic journal articles discussing certain parts of it. And I became aware of this, and I looked at what he'd written, and I realized that it had been badly edited, and I couldn't figure out who exactly was attacking me. So I wrote him an email at Boston University. And he very politely provided the proper text, and we corresponded back and forth for a bit, and that was that. He never made any effort to interview me about any of this stuff. It's all been derived from massive reading. It's really strange. I mean, it's an odd sort of thing.
Well, there's a book out by a fellow named Curtis Dozier called The White Pedestal, How White Nationalists Use Classical Culture to Promote Hate. And of all places, Yale University Press published this. It's a screed, and it's hilarious, though, for a couple of reasons. One reason is that it begins with a note about sources, and it says that he's not going to cite the sources because he doesn't want to encourage people to actually read the people he's going to discuss. And
I've seen this, yes.
I was just floored by that, the incivility of that attitude.
And also, of course, the naked totalitarianism of it.
We're unpeople. He would prefer that we not even exist and that our writings be unavailable. But the next best thing is just to write to screeds attacking us, but not provide citations. Honestly,
Of
it
course,
strikes me as something that should be censured by his university, works
I
like
was going to
that.
say it's scandalous that the Yale University Press would let that happen. They have edited, don't they? It's just unbelievable. I mean, nothing's. No, I would. We would believe anything from these people, but it is a, you know, to any rational person, it's unbelievable.
I still get surprised by these people, and I guess that's good that they can still surprise me. I'm not so cynical that this didn't shock me a little bit. The other thing that's quite amusing about this book, though, is that for years he's published this blog called Pharos, where he's been defending the classics against bad people like me who want to make reference to, say, the decline of the Roman Empire and things like that, and use these as analogies. You're talking about ancient Greek philosophy and in our context. And he was trying to defend all of this stuff from us. But by the time he came to write this book, he realized, no, they're right. The Western tradition belongs to the far right, and fooey on it. And so he's written this entire book basically saying, you know, actually, all these horrible haters really are with quite in the spirit of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and their interpretations are quite in the spirit of some of the great classicists of all time. I thought, great, the guy's just wrapped up classical studies and delivered it to us
Greg,
as
have
a
you written
present.
about this? Have you
I'm
written about this?
not yet, but I'm going to review it after I review Hayek's Bastards. So I'm going to.
I was I thought I'd seen it on Countercurrents. I
Well,
thought.
I made a reference to it in one of my pieces where I just discovered this and was rather
Well,
shocked
you
at the
know,
incivility.
I look at Countercurrents every morning, so that's but that I'm sure that's where I saw it.
Well, I'm flattered.
There's actually kind of a subculture, so an industry, a minor industry of writing about the radical right from a left-wing perspective, isn't there? There's another book that came out a little while ago by some woman or other. I have to look it up, but I know that she completely mischaracterized our clash with the T.J. James. And I now what the hell was her name? It got
There's a
reviewed by
hello.
all the usual people, of course. That's the thing about Slobodan, which really fascinates me. Do you realize, though, that although he got all these Bigfoot reviews from the establishment left, there are no reviews from the right? I actually wrote to, well, there were two reviews from Libertarian. The Institute for Economic Affairs reviewed it, and they're extremely upset that they basically say that he's accusing them of racism, which, of course, is actually what he's doing. And one of the reviewers' arguments was, nobody's ever heard of Peter Brimelow. Why is he making giving him such
Why is he making him so prominent? But you know, the Wall Street Journal's not reviewed this book. National Review's not reviewed the book. American Spectator's not reviewed it. American Conservative's not reviewed it. It's really strange. It's widely reviewed on the left and not at all on the establishment right.
Well, they're
Why is that?
afraid. They know that there's a lot to this, and they want to ignore the thesis. Earlier generations of people writing for those very same publications, in some cases, were far braver and more open-minded than these people are. And so I think they want to just sweep all this under the rug, frankly. I think the book you're trying to remember is a book by a woman named Laura Field called Furious Minds.
Yes, that's right. That's it.
Yeah, I started reading it. There's this funny little internet meme. It's a two-panel meme. And the first panel says, how men take a photograph of something, and it's like a building. And the second is how women take a photograph of something. And there's the building in the background and the woman making a selfie of herself in the foreground. And this is exactly the way this woman writes this book. It's so annoying. She's in the foreground in every chapter. She's got to weave a narrative about herself into this every chapter. And it starts to become sort of like that a horrible book by Ellie Reeve, Blackpilled, where she talks about the alt-right. It has a sort of dear diary, this is what these hateful racists made me feel today. It's insufferable. So it goes on at great length, great insufferable length, a lot of it about herself. But it is interesting because she's telling the story of how the West Coast Straussians influenced basically populist nationalism in America today. So it sort of is another parallel thought current to the kind of stuff that Slobodian is talking about. It's useful in and of itself, but it's just written in such an annoying and solipsistic fashion, whereas Slobodian is very factual,
Right.
which I find very useful. But it is weird that these people, I describe them as stalkers. There's this guy, Ronald Beener. I wrote a review of one of his books recently. He's sort of like an academic stalker. Dozier is kind of like an academic stalker. And yet these people would never interview us. They would never just, drop me an email. They have a theory about this or that, or they think I mean this and not that. They just write it. They don't ask. And I think it's hilarious because I would respond to them.
Yes.
There's this Heidegger scholar named Richard Fried who wrote a pretty nasty screed, Something Wicked This Way Comes, talking about Heidegger and bad people like me. And I saw this online and I wrote to him. And I said, there are some things in here that really aren't accurate. And I said, and the scariest thing you actually have me saying basically boils down to this. I want to change the laws and then have the police enforce them. And he wrote back, he clearly didn't want to have any kind of correspondence. And he published this piece and he acknowledges that I wrote to him. But these people are very, very uncomfortable because they don't want to have an actual conversation with any of the people they write about. They really want to be as remote from us as entomologists are from bugs.
I have to say, though, Greg, that I've heard this complaint from editors that the younger journalists won't interview people. They just expect to find everything online. I think there is some truth in that, but I agree. I think they are. I think in the case of the establishment right not reviewing this book, the problem is they are still spooked by race. They see this as an attempt to smear them as racist, and it actually is. But the problem is they don't have any defense to it. I mean, what thinking about the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the intellectual collapse of socialism, of course, what's the really critical thing that's going on now, which is presaged in Slobodian's work here, is the collapse of the integration myth. I'm old enough to remember it, but if you go read Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, for example, and the struggle to get the Civil Rights Act through it in 64. The amazing thing about it is that it's obvious that the Northern Republicans had absolutely no idea why Southern whites were resisting integration. But of course, the Southern whites were resisting integration is because they knew it wouldn't work, and they knew it would destroy their way of life in their neighborhoods. And it has done that. So now we're faced with this catastrophic disaster with every American city being jungle, in the middle of every American city being a jungle and so on, and the immense cost of affirmative action to everybody. And they just don't want to grapple with that at all. They still don't want to grapple with it. The revolution is not yet complete.
Yeah, they're always saying we've got a lot more work to do. And we need to have a conversation about this. And the conversation consists of us shutting up and listening to them lecture. That really is the idea of a conversation that these academics have, if they're going to deign to have any conversation.
But in the case of the establishment right, National Review and so on, I mean, don't they realize why Trump was elected? I mean, the Republican Party, they lost control of the party because they weren't responding to, realities. They are still not responding to realities. So, we've got somewhere to go.
So did you ever meet or read Wilmot Robertson?
Yes, yeah, both.
What were your thoughts about him?
Well, his book, The Majority, it was a thunderbolt. I mean, it's a tremendous piece of work, and it's a completely integrated view of what's going on in America. So I was immensely impressed by it. And then he started, as you know, a magazine called Inspiration. And I subscribed to it, and we corresponded. And eventually I went to see him. He lived in Western North Carolina, up in the mountains. I met him twice, actually. He also he used to stay with Carlton Putnam's widow in McLean, and every it was kind of a vacation he and his family would go on. He was quite a lot older than his wife, and they had young children, and I guess this was kind of a vacation that they used to go on to go stay in the DC area. I think he was a remarkable figure. I mean, that book is an underground classic, of course.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the classiest books I've ever read. He doesn't people can always misquote you and misrepresent you and so forth, but he gives them no material to do that. It is very judicious. It is very classy, very well argued. I remember I reread once The Closing of the American Mind. This was after I'd sort of made my conversion. This was about 2001, and I reread it. I thought, this is a very classy book. Almost on the level of the dispossessed majority. I met him once. It was almost exactly 25 years ago. It was in March of 2001. And I was driving up to an event put on by the Council of Conservative Citizens in North Carolina. And I was with Sam Dixon, and we went and visited Wilmot Robertson. He signed one of my books of his, The Dispossessed Majority. He signed another person's book, and he was very old at that point, and he wrote the person's name, but then he forgot to actually put his signature after it, which is kind of funny. Then later on that trip, I believe it was the same trip, I met for the first time Jared Taylor in San Francisco. So that was a pretty memorable weekend. Yeah, he was an amazingly talented figure and very energetic to put out a monthly magazine for what,
pre-internet,
25 years, pre-internet.
Just
putting it together must have been a tremendous labor. And hand to the proof. We remember the days when we used to have to cut articles to fit spaces. He had to do all of that.
What about Jean Raspail?
Well, of course, I've not met. I didn't meet Raspail.
The VDEF Foundation actually bought up all the copies of Camp of the Saints. It was John Tanton at US Inc., publisher of Social Contract. He actually organized to publish a special edition of it. So the Baldwin said it was published by other people as well, but I don't think that's true. In any case, when, for reasons which bear examination, right after John died, the US Inc. closed down suddenly. And they were going to throw these books away. And we bought them, and we still have some. And we, for the last couple of years of VDEF Lab, we used to sell them at a premium. There's now a new edition out, as you know, by Vauban Books.
I haven't read that yet.
Do you read French, Greg?
I used to read it quite well, but I'm shocked at how rusty it's gotten. And really, it was starting in 2019, when it just became automatic. I would go to French language sites, and Google would trans or whatever browser I was using would just translate everything into English. And I thought, surely this is just convenient, and surely this won't have any effect. My ability to read French and German has cratered since then. It's remarkable how quick it is. But no, I used to read a lot of this writing in French, and I've translated a number of things from French over the years. And in the early days of Countercurrents, I was translating a lot of things by, say, well, Guillaume Fay, essays by Fay, things by Benoit, things by Venner, and others. But I never read here a respite in the French.
Well, the reason I asked that is I know that's a new translation that they have out now, and they were pretty scathing about the old translation. So I probably I really should reread it. We're thanked in the introduction because Lydia helped them deal with the French publisher who have been very difficult.
Oh, I'm
We
glad to hear that.
intended to republish it ourselves, of course, but Letitia James intervened, as on so many of our projects.
Yeah, I had looked into perhaps doing a new edition of that myself. I was glad somebody finally did it. I think there's a tendency when people do new translations to emphasize a bit much how much of an improvement they've made. I'm sure there are little things here and there where they made improvements, and also they translated a later edition where the author himself had made improvements or changes, including cutting some things, as I understand. So
That's interesting.
my sense is that perhaps the original translation wasn't all that bad, because people do have a tendency to oversell new translations for whatever
Of course,
reason.
the fundamental idea, which is the fact that the West had no will to resist this kind of invasion, is so brilliant that it would carry a lot of bad translation.
Oh yeah, exactly. I think the message came through loud and clear, which is one of the reasons why the book is so valued by some and hated by and feared by many.
Right.
So let's see if we have some questions from our audience here. I don't want to neglect them. Dalriada has sent $150. Thank you so much. That's a very generous donation, no question, but we very much appreciate it. David Zutty has a question for you, and this is about contemporary politics. Do you think Tucker Carlson might run for president someday?
Well, hello, David. Nice to hear from you. I think it's not impossible. I noticed that Scott Greer recently said that he thinks that Tucker would be a factor if he chose to run in the Republican primaries. He thinks he would get about he'd be up to about 15% of the vote, which in a divided primary would put him with striking range of victory. I think it is possible. He might be forced to run for president in a way by the ferocity of the attacks against him, which are really extraordinary. I listened to his most recent couple of podcasts, where he discusses the influence of Chabad, and he didn't call for violence against Chabad. He hardly ever even mentioned Chabad, but of course the Twitter sphere is hysterical about it. Of course, these people are not used to being criticized is part of the problem, so they respond with characteristic of narcissistic personality syndrome. People respond to lethal rage by being with the criticized. And I think there's a lot of that going on there. I think it's not impossible. He's only 56. He's not as wealthy as Trump, but he's pretty strong in a pretty strong position financially. I think it's not impossible. And it really matters whether this is I guess ultimately the ultimate issue that needs to be surfaced, which is the role of Zionism in American politics. I do think that sooner or later it is going to. I've thought, for many, many years that sooner or later this has to get into politics, and it is getting into politics, more on the left than on the right.
Yeah.
So Tucker is doing the Republican Party a great service, which I'm sure he's not grateful at all, by retaining a foothold in this emerging debate.
Absolutely. Did you see the story? I think it was in Zero Hedge about the Democrats' postmortem for their defeat. And one of the things that they claimed contributed to their defeat was the fact that the party establishment was completely out of sync with the party base on the issue of Zionism.
I believe that post-mortem was never published, was it? It's been leaked in bits and pieces, and that's probably the reason. The Democrats have a huge problem here. Partly, it's very largely their own fault, because they've imported a natural anti-Zionist constituency in the form of Muslim immigrants and colored immigrants in general. And so that's going to be a very difficult circle to square, although I'm sure they're thinking about it. But you see, and Tucker mentioned this last night, that Gavin Newsom apparently said yesterday, Israel is an apartheid state, which of course is obviously true, and that it has too much influence on American politics. I mean, that's a stunning thing for the governor of California to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's absolutely the fault of people like Trump for handing them this weapon to bash him with. It doesn't speak ill of Gavin Newsom for doing this. It speaks ill of mainstream Republican right for basically giving them the opportunity to do
That's
that.
right. That's right. I mean, I appreciated you put out, I think, just a note on this war a little while ago, which I restacked, saying that you thought the most important issue, as I understand, remember it, you said the most important issue facing America is the great replacement of mass immigration. You're not going to blow up the Trump coalition over this war, although it's obvious to everyone that there's no American interest in this war. And that's also a new thing. I don't remember that being said during the Iraq War, although it was equally a Zionist racket.
Yeah, I remember in the run-up to the Iraq War when people were talking about, the fix behind this and so forth. And we were much more marginal then than this message is now. So again, I think this is a sign of great progress, intellectual progress, and also progress in creating alternative media and growing the audiences of these alternative media, because now things that were totally marginal 25 years ago are mainstream. And I think that's really been a remarkable step forward.
Yep, I wish I could have the data to publicize
Yeah, well, just keep building your Substack. I do think it's important
it.
for you to have your own platform out there through all of this. So I have a question here from our friend Archie. Archie sends $5. Thank you. The conversation is a pleasant surprise. Shocking and fascinating. Do you think that the effects of the Iran war have lost Trump's base? And if so, what can his base do to make Trump do what will regain their loyalty? Do you think that this war is going to blow up the Trump coalition? And what can Trump do to fix that?
Well, what he can do, of course, is declare victory and leave, which is what Tucker is urging, apparently. I don't know that he can't, that Israelis will let him do that. And I don't actually see what victory would mean. I see what it means from the Israelis' point of view. It means Iran is totally destroyed and turned into a shambles like Iraq. I don't know that that's clearly not in America's interest to have instability in that area. I guess maybe I'm just Pollyannish about it, but I do think the base can be held together because, unless the war gets very much nastier and prices rise very dramatically and that kind of thing, and then obviously they are going to rise. Trump has done a great deal, more accurately, I think Stephen Miller done a great deal on immigration. They're very close to getting, they've reduced legal immigration very dramatically. Illegal immigration has been halted at the border. And there's a net, the foreign-born population is falling, which it hasn't done this consistently for a very long time. And so that's all great. My sense is that issue is big enough to overcome a foreign war if the foreign war doesn't become too obtrusive. But on the other hand, what a hell of a risk he's taking. The more I think about it, never recovered from the First World War. But it was like a Chinese executioner sword. It went through the neck of the country in just 4 years, and now his head's fallen off. It's taken 100 years for the full effect of the First War to be felt. It gets you very alarmed if you think about that parallel. Have you ever read Churchill's My Early Life?
No, I've never read that.
Well, I urge you to read it or at least listen to it, because first of all, he's a great writer, of course. Whatever else you can say out of the old bastard, he was a tremendous writer. It covers his, he writes about his period when he was at Sandhurst in the 1890s, with it's the equivalent of West Point. And he said there was, at that point, the empire had been more or less at peace for nearly 20 years. And so the army was running out of combat veterans. There just weren't that many combat veterans, but they were aging out. Mm-hmm. And the universal assumption which penetrated his classmates is that there was simply never going to be another major war. Mm-hmm. And that was commonly believed by the educated classes. Of course, it's like the 1990s and Fukuyama. And if you think about it, and particularly how you have children military age, as I do, I mean, it's extremely frightening. The parallels mm-hmm. are so close. The parallels are so close. And it can happen suddenly. Mm-hmm. Just the whole damn thing spins out of control.
Yeah. Well, I'm very worried about this. My fear is that he's lost enough of his base already. Because a lot of the people who were attracted to Trump, we're not attracted to Trump for the reasons I was attracted to him, concerned about the great replacement, stuff like that. They were concerned about things like war. He has a lot of independents who were kind of cranky in America, cranky, politically disaffected independents. This looks like business as usual. They don't like war. I think a lot of these people are going to be out. Trump isn't going to be running in the midterms. He's not going to be running in 2028 anyway. A lot of the people who would only come out for Trump, color them gone already. But to keep enough of the people who voted for him coming to the polls after this shocking betrayal, I think it's going to be almost miraculous. And my fear is that all the good things that he's done on immigration, it's just going to all be undone. Because the left is going to just come back into power, and that's it, which is a really sobering, unhappy thought.
I mean, it is, absolutely. On the other hand, you know, the thing about Trump is he just can't be trusted either way. If it was George Bush, we'd know this was a permanent sellout, but with Trump, you don't know. And I think the State of the Union was a triumph for him. I mean, he actually succeeded in maneuvering the Democrats to remaining seated when he was saying we all want to remain, you know, stand up even if you want to get illegal aliens out of the country. They don't, all of them. Not one of them stood up. I guess Fetterman might have stood up, the Kansas Senator from Pennsylvania. So he was actually in very good shape after the State of the Union. For that matter, he was very good shape after in Minneapolis, although he obviously blinked. But he was on the point of getting to the stage where the Democrats are openly calling for an insurrection. They're openly saying, I mean, this actually is an insurrection. They will not allow the federal government to enforce the law in their territory. He should. The next move, of course, was to impose the Insurrection Act and arrest Governor Walz and Mayor Fry, you know, and then run on that issue. So it's heartbreaking how close we were to doing that, making the national question the key issue in politics.
Yeah, I would have loved that. I would have been able to forgive a lot of things if he had done that. But he was simultaneously retreating from Minneapolis and advancing on Iran. And that just indicates to me that he's not ultimately working for us. There are other interests, foreign interests, that have veto power. You know, they created this America First movement, and then they allowed this little Israel First wing to be added on to the America First movement. And now the wing is, you know, flying the bird. The tail is wagging the dog, so to speak. And right. You can't hide this. You can't hide that this is a betrayal. You can't hide that Israel First policies are a betrayal of an America First movement. You could hide that if you were just talking about the old Republican Party, talking about values, things like that, that transcended nationalism, then you could engage in all kinds of petty ethnic feuds and squabbles and also all kinds of business deals under that guise. We're just about values, good governance, global peace, whatever. But you can't disguise it when you're explicitly under the banner of America First.
Right. I just have to hope that he, you know, bounced back. I mean, that he has somewhere. I mean, I think that the Israelis intend to break Iran up. And it's extremely disturbing to me that Trump is supporting a Kurdish insurrection. I mean, I feel bad for the Kurds. I think the Kurds have a very rough time and all that kind of. But it's not America's problem. The fact that he looks like he's going to break up, that's, in other words, that whole area is going to be in complete chaos, and that's where most of the world's getting its oil from.
Yeah, well, that's where most of the world's getting its oil from, and that's where Europe has been getting millions of very unwelcome refugees from.
Right.
We're going to see a lot higher prices for everything and a lot more aggressive fighting age males showing up in dinghies in Europe if Israel gets its way on this. I don't want either of those things to happen, obviously. And it's totally bad for Trump being able to move forward on the good things that he's actually done.
Right.
So Archie sends another $5. He suggests, vote for me. I speak for white people, as Tucker Carlson's 2032 presidential campaign slogan. Why not 2028, Archie?
Yeah. I have to say, I actually think highly of Vance. I think Vance has got a very good grasp of a lot of these issues, but maybe that this war will damage him. He'll be unavoidably tainted.
Well, the New York Times article about this, which basically said, why are we having this war? Israel said so. Nobody in the administration felt comfortable saying no. Also included that Vance was part of the yes saying here. And if that's true, again, that's going to harm him with a lot of people. And it's hilarious that we had all these people talking about no more forever wars, and then we watched the time frame of this war go from 2 to 3 days to 4 weeks or less to 4 or 5 weeks. Eventually, Trump said forever is necessary.
I read that to say that Vance was in favor of a larger strike because he wanted to get in and out quickly. Mm-hmm. And if that's all, at least his motives are good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I just think, though, that so many people for whom this was a central issue feel very betrayed. And I don't quite know how they're going to win those people back. I don't know if it was even possible under ideal conditions to get everybody who voted for Trump voting for his designated successor. Or the GOP, your generic GOP ticket in the midterms this year. And now I think that that's going to be almost impossible. So I fear for the future of the good things that Trump has accomplished.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it? I mean, just it came so close.
Yeah, it came so close, and it confirms all the worst stereotypes at the same time. It's...
You know, one of the things Slobodin has done is he's in the middle of his book promotion tour, he went off X. I haven't bothered to look, but I think maybe he wanted to be one of these people who's moved to Blue Sky because he doesn't like rubbing shoulders with uncouth people on Twitter. I would love to know, I guess I could go and look it up right now, but if he said anything about this war. I think he's an extreme leftist. I'm always interested to know what they think about this war. It may be that the coalition that succeeds Trump is not a Zionist coalition.
Mm-hmm. In which case, I think, again, the question of will Tucker throw his hat in the ring is a very good question. I hope he does. I honestly hope he does, if only to keep these people honest. Maybe they need a stalking horse candidate to keep them honest. But I would actually prefer that he run and win. So I have another question here from Wilbot. Okay. Wilbot wants to know, what's next for you if VDare doesn't come back? What are you going to do if you can't in some way revive VDare?
Obviously, Greg, I will continue to speak out on Substack for as long as Substack lets us do this. I mean, the more serious question, frankly, is what about the writers I had? and who not just the people who were with me for 25 years, like James Fulford, but also had new writers I was working with, was actually planning to bring on board as a successor. And if the institution's destroyed, they have to reinvent the wheel. I'm very impressed with James Carson, who runs White Papers Institute. Have you seen that? Excellent work. And I was talking to him about forming some kind of strategic alliance. He's going to have to invent. I mean, we had a very good fundraising system set up. Lydia turned out to be an excellent fundraiser. So as long as we had the product, we could really build an institution. One thing we're definitely going to do is hold more conferences. And we're talking about doing one at the end of the summer. You know, right now we're facing massive litigation. We've been sued personally and through the foundation. And we just had two absolutely disastrous rulings from Sabrina Krauss, who is our arch enemy in the New York District Court level, just disregarding the evidence. And she's trying to impose enormous fines on us for alleged contempt of court for not producing stuff fast enough. I mean, it's hell. It's an utter hell. And this lawfare thing is extremely serious. And the American legal system, judicial system, is going to have to be turned upside down because of this. Bad enough what they did to Trump, but what they did to the J6, is indeed every damned Republican in the DC circuit, is like Moscow show trials, you know. And at the same time, we see that it turns out that the Republicans, the DOJ, is absolutely unable to commit to indict Democrats for anything. Democrats just can't indict Democrats, no matter how egregious the crime is. I mean, Letitia James, for example, is clearly guilty of massive mortgage fraud going back for 40 years. The grand juries in D.C. and in the Eastern District of Virginia just simply will not indict her. It's a dark prospect for us and for everybody we're working with. And frankly, it's a very dark prospect for equality before the law.
Mm-hmm. Is there any organized move within the current administration to give some relief for these lawfare problems?
Well, yes, there was. Ed Martin was in looking at the weaponization of lawfare, but you know, he seems to have lost out on some kind of internal power struggle in the DOJ. So at the moment, it seems to be stalled. I mean, the thing about Trump, one of the things that's annoying about Trump is he does so many damn things at once. Why doesn't he just focus? All this involving the ballroom and the White House, true. I mean, it's just and renaming the Kennedy Center and all that. I mean, they should just defund the DC circuit, which is an absolute rat's nest of commies and Democrats to the extent they could be distinguished.
So why don't we circle back to this book? I think this book is actually a rather impressive piece of work, even though I'm not crazy about the author's biases, and his analysis is basically sort of implicitly Marxoid. But he assembles a pretty good case for looking at a lot of people who are quite in the mainstream from the 70s into the 90s and creating a narrative that's pointing in the direction of nationalism and populism, realism about race, realism about the national question and things like that. I'm very impressed by this. One of the reasons I like this book is because it shows that we're not such voices in the wilderness like we might think we are. There's a book called Documents of American Prejudice. It was brought out, I think, by the Free Press or one of these mainstream New York publishers back in the 80s, I think it was. And it's edited by T.S. Joshi, who's a Indian of the dot variety scholar. He's most known for his work on H.P. Lovecraft. But what he does is he assembles all of these racialist and nationalist writings. And when I started getting into this and thinking very seriously about the race question, I took a lot of heart from this. It was Michael Thompson, actually, who gave me a tip about this book and showed it to me. So it was a bit later than when I first got involved. But when I looked at this, I thought, well, we are not alone. There's a long tradition. It was comparable in effect to reading Christopher Lash's book, The True and Only Heaven, which is about sort of radical populist strands in American thought going all the way back, you know, to the beginnings. Again, I felt rooted in a tradition, and I felt like there were a lot of very sensible people who were building in the direction of what we have today. And I thought that was an encouraging thing. It's nice to know that these resources were there. It's nice to be able to look back and see a narrative and see a development that is leading to where we are today.
Yes, well, one thing that I took a lot of pleasure from this book is that at one point he says that my work, you know, basically reconciling immigration restriction, low immigration with free markets, was internally coherent, and internally coherent worldview. That is kind of a reassuring thing in that these ideas do fit together. And they generate power from the fact that they fit together. Ultimately, will prevail because of that. Because of the left wing view does not fit together. They can't account for racial differences and the human individual. I guess what they call individual differences, and they can't run a society in the way that they want to anyway. So I found that very, very reassuring.
So I have another question here. Who do you follow on Substack, and do you recommend any particular people whom you read on Substack?
I'm just getting into this. I see that you've recommended me, Greg, because I'm getting people signing up because of you. My Substack is free, incidentally, I should say. People do give me money, but it's that's just out of the goodness of their hearts. I'm not really sure. I haven't really mastered the entire Substack universe. Obviously, you're on it. And I follow my refugees from the Vida shipwreck who are on it, Federale, James Fulford, Patrick Cleburne, and so on. Beyond that, there's a whole raft of extreme interesting Substack I frankly haven't mastered yet. What about you? Who do you follow?
I follow, well, Millennial Woes. I follow Morgoth. I find their work to be excellent. There's a young fellow named Chris Brunette.
Yes, I follow him.
I think very highly of him. He's quite brave, he's quite intelligent, and he's a good writer and a really good researcher.
I think highly of him because he's one of the very few people on the right who've actually, he wrote an article for American Conservative about a year ago about our struggle with Letitia James. I mean, as you know, as I told Tucker, one of the things I'm bitter about is the almost complete absence of any support from people I've known for 40 years on the American right. Just not helped us. My sense of these judges is that they're not swayed by considerations of law or fact or common decency. The only thing that seems to sway them is some sense of what the political climate is. And that's why Judge Merchant, whatever his name is, the Colombian war judge, backed off on the fraud charges against Trump. You know, he went to the trouble of the legal theory was ridiculous. He allowed the case to go forward. It was tried. Trump was convicted. He suspended sentencing until after the election. After the election, he gives him an unconditional discharge. If he was going to get an unconditional discharge, why the hell did they go to trial in the first place? I think that had more people spoken up in our defense, that might very well have had an influence on these judges. But I don't mean to interrupt. Who else do you follow?
Let's see. I follow Josh Neal's Psychopolitics. I follow James O'Meara, who writes for Countercurrents. He just does notes on there, but I find his notes to be very entertaining. I haven't followed a whole lot of people yet. And then I follow people who are outside the political sphere just because they're doing stuff that I think is interesting. People putting up stuff on medieval art or jazz or whatever. So it's a nice world. I am banned from X.
When did that happen?
The first time it happened was under Dorsey. No.
I think so. I remember it happening. Yeah. You said you'd given up reading Twitter, so you didn't even notice for a while.
Yeah. Then I had another account, though. I had three accounts. I had a countercurrents account, I had a personal account, and then I had an account for a YouTube channel that I had created that didn't go anywhere because YouTube started censoring everything, and I wasn't going to invest any time if it was just going to get taken down. But I still had this Twitter account. So what I did is I just posted on my and used my personal account to read things. And that account was banned under Musk. And so I used my YouTube channel account to continue reading things. And then I appealed to get my personal account back just on a whim. I would do it once a month or so. And I did it, went for a walk, came home and found that the account was back. But by that time, the two accounts that I was using, it and the one I was actively using, had the same number of followers, and it just didn't matter right at that point. And then both of them were shut down at the same time. So I had an alt, and that was shut down fairly recently. So I've given up on the platform, and I thought, well, I created this Substack for the New Nationalism podcast series that Angelo was doing. And that series came to an end, a premature end. So I thought I would just use the thing. It's monetized. It already had subscribers to make this my presence on Substack, because it's a universe unto itself. And there are a lot of people who go there because they like reading long form essays. And that's actually a natural environment for the kind of stuff I put out at Countercurrents anyway. So I'm enjoying building up an audience there, and I'm discovering new people actively too. I haven't gotten to the point where I just have a list of people that if you follow me, you can, you know, just tick a box and follow all these other people as well. I haven't figured out how to do that yet, but I will.
I should have mentioned, by the way, is Ken Gividen, Gividen. He specialized in following black and white crime. And this was probably the most successful series we had on VDA. I used to go to Month in the Death of White America, and we just list off all these black and white killings every month with photographs. It was utterly heartrending. He did all the work for it, and I used to do the analysis. Well, after Bidair suspended, I urged him to get onto Substack, and he had his own Substack, which is monetized, although you can see large parts of it. And what I do is he runs his list every month, and then I will come in and do, that's what I have to do when I get off the phone with you, is do an analysis of it, what kind of trends we see and that kind of thing. So I had to let him declare, I encouraged him to declare independence, because frankly I just couldn't pay him. Mm-hmm. His Substack is doing quite well.
Good.
And I promote it when I write my analysis. I always urge people to sign up for him.
Now, you see, the thing about that, Greg, is it's a very low concept article, but every month between 30 and 50 whites are killed by blacks in America in the most horrific circumstances, and you never hear mm-hmm. about it. There's never more than four or five whites, white on black killings, often in self-defense. Mm-hmm. And this is a central reality of American life, and it's completely buried by the establishment press, with the result that we get ridiculous hoaxes like this Black Lives Matter hoax.
Right.
You know, people were polled, and people were telling pollsters that they think they were thought 10,000 unarmed blacks were killed by the police every year. Mm-hmm. You know, because complete false conscience produced by the regime media. And we were doing our part to undermine that.
So I have a question here from Miles. Miles would like to know your thoughts on the rise of the remigration idea in Europe.
This absolutely breaks, I'm sorry to keep going on about this, about VDA. This actually breaks my heart, because I've been fascinated by the idea of remigration for a long time. And in fact, when I suspended VDA, I had two articles on the stocks about an instance of remigration, one of them being the Protestants leaving Southern Ireland, and the other being English speakers leaving Quebec. In both cases, there's been substantial demographic change in those states, because they what for, by one means or another, these undesirable minorities were encouraged to leave. Well, the next step I found was Carlson with his white papers. He calls it repatriation, but he did a whole series of articles about repatriation. I was able to run one or two on V-Day, but since then he's running them at very regular intervals on his website, and his Twitter feed. He's come up with some remarkable examples. For example, Kazakhstan, you know, the former Soviet republic. After the Soviet Union collapsed, at the time the Soviet Union collapsed, northern Kazakhstan was heavily Russified. There's a huge population of Russians, and the Kazakhs were on the point of being, I think they may actually have been a minority in their own state. But that's all reversed now. The Russians have emigrated to, have gone back to Russia. In fact, in many cases, gone to Russia because they were born in Kazakhstan and stayed there for generations. But the Kazakhs have got control of their state again. So remigration does work. Now, I have to say that I believe that Carlson and the White Papers were first before Martin Selner started on the idea. But of course, Selner's done a great job. There are people who think, I mean, Nick Griffin and Mark Collette, although they, you know, at odds with each other personally, they agree in saying that remigration is a dream, a delusion. It can't possibly happen in the numbers that would make a serious difference to the demographic direction of the country. I don't really think that's true, but I also think it can't hurt. And so I think it's a really highly desirable. I mean, one of the things that should be done here, of course, is to ban immigrants from affirmative action policies. I mean, if you could have affirmative action in American universities, which is still continued, of course, because these bureaucrats have no intention of obeying the law. Very often it's Caribbean blacks and African blacks and Indians who benefit from these quotas. It's not the native born blacks at all. So if you were to unwind that, the incentive to import African academics would go away. There's a lot of stuff that could be done like that. In Britain, I mean, the obvious thing to do is it's true in the States too. I mean, restore freedom of association. Let people discriminate. If they want to have restrictive covenants and not sell houses to immigrants or to blacks, so they should be allowed to do it. That was abolished. Yet another disastrous Supreme Court decision. It should be restored.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think that the people who say remigration is a dream, actually, it is sort of a dream. It is an imaginative concept. But not that imaginative. If it's possible for people to come, it's possible for them to leave. And given how rootless people are these days anyway, given how easy it is to move large numbers of people logistically these days, it's never been easier to move large numbers of people, which is part of our problem. The problem is they're coming only one way, but the same means can be used to reverse these population flows. It's just a matter of will.
That's what you said to me when we first met. You know, you said in San Francisco, you said, well, they came and they can go, which of course that summarizes it. One of the corollaries to remigration, though, is denaturalization. You know, I mean, the issue here, the critical issue, is to keep these people out of the political nation, stop them from voting.
Right.
In order to retain the historic American nation's electoral integrity. And, you know, that can be done, of course, and it should be done by reviewing people's citizenship applications and so on. I think another step that should be taken is simply lengthening the amount of time it takes to become a citizen. It's 5 years now, but it has been longer. Under the Federalists, I believe, it was quite a lot longer. And so I think it should be 20 years, 25 years. Why not?
Indeed. I think that's very, very reasonable. I have a question here from Mark. Mark wants to know, what about the Dubai model? I know Dubai is getting pasted right now by drones and rockets, but Dubai has a society with a large number of foreign workers who come there to do everything basically for the natives, and yet they are completely locked out of the political society.
Right.
I hesitate to suggest this as a model. because it's basically guest workers, right? And we tried guest workers, and for some unaccountable reason, we just can't resist after a while having guest workers around, just giving them things like citizenship and welfare and stuff like that. But as long as there's economic arguments that are being made, and Trump is a sucker for these arguments, depending on who the last person he talked to was, as long as economic arguments are made about immigration, why not just say, fine, we can have immigration, but these people will never become citizens. They will never become voters. And eventually they'll have to leave. Why can't we just do that? Why can't we split the immigration block, basically, between the leftists who just want these people here for mischief's sake, and the people who are on the right, broadly, who want them here for economic reasons? Why can't we split that solid pro-immigration block by saying, look, fine, economic migrants can come, but they will never become citizens. They will be treated with all their human rights, right? Of course, just like a tourist or anybody who sets foot on our shores. They have all the human rights, no civil rights, and they will never become citizens. Why would that not fly?
It actually nearly did fly at the time of the Smith-Simpson bill. When they sabotaged the Smith-Simpson bill, which was a bill in the 90s to substantially reduce immigration, which had tremendous momentum behind it, and it looked like it was going to pass. It was eventually sabotaged by a combination of leftist lobbying and business lobbying and the Wall Street Journal and so on. At one point, Al Simpson, was the senator from Wyoming, actually told me that they had a compromise whereby they were going to let people in, but they wouldn't be eligible for citizenship. They have an expanded guest worker program, and the left wing part of the coalition wouldn't go for that. The business part of the coalition was prepared to go for it. Of course, you can't make guest worker programs work with if you have birthright citizenship, because if they come in as guests and then have children here, as a practical matter, it's impossible to get them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if you address that issue. I think that is one way that we could maybe cut the model, or we put it this way. We could split the pro-immigration coalition that way, which would be a good thing. Always unify your side and split your enemy camp if you can. And it would slow down demographic change, basically.
I mean, what it wouldn't do is reduce, it would reduce the labor market effect, the impact on, you know, wages. But
exactly.
But it's obvious that the political class doesn't care about that.
Right.
I mean, in many respects, the H-1B program is a sort of a guest worker program. They are all supposed to go back, although a lot of them don't. But they are definitely impacting STEM wages and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, this would be the guest worker program that your boss would like, but your boss wants to pay you less. So much for populism, but it would be at least something to slow down the demographic replacement, which I think would be a good thing. So it can, I think, be floated as something, at least to put it out there. Because a lot of people just think if they come here, they can all become citizens. There are countries around the world where that's simply not possible.
That's right.
And yet people flock in and they make a living, they send money home, they go home eventually, and it works.
I mean, it works if you have the will to do it. The problem with Western societies don't. The critical point is this birthright citizenship thing has to be solved. I mean, Trump is trying to, it's amazing, really. The first article we wrote on birthright citizenship was in 2000, the first year we were operating. And that issue has moved into public debate. I mean, I remember when McCain was on the campaign trail, he was seeing a clip of him talking in some greasy spoon to about birthright citizenship. Somebody asked him about birthright citizenship, and he said, it's in the Constitution. And the guy questioned him, said, no, it's not in the Constitution, it's a judicial decision. So at this level, I think it was in Iowa or something, the people were making the connection that this is all nonsense about birthright citizenship. And so that has been huge progress. What Trump is trying to do is do it through an executive order. And I have to say that it never occurred to me that it could be done that way. Michael Fairman wrote an article about it under the first Trump administration, and I was sort of surprised that it was the guy who wrote the thing about the article got tremendous traction in during the first Trump election about Russian cockpit.
Oh, Michael Anton, yeah.
That's right. He proposed this idea back then. He kept thinking that Trump was going to do it, but you know, and make it an executive order. But he didn't. But he did do when he came back in the early part of this last year. Now the problem is the Supreme Court may very well reject that, and people will conclude from that, given the primitive way people think about the Supreme Court, that this means a message has come down from God that birthright citizenship is in fact in the Constitution. So, but it's not at all. It could be reversed by statute, or for that matter, necessarily pass a constitutional amendment. People will say to you, you couldn't possibly get a constitutional amendment through, you have to get through whatever it is, two-thirds of the states or something. But the point is to run on it, to make the political issue and run on it, because most Americans are astonished to hear that if illegals come in here and have a child here, or for that matter, tourists comes in here and has a child here, that child's American citizen and is eligible for all kinds of benefits and so on, and can ultimately sponsor its own parents. And the people find that just incredible. And they just don't know about it. At least they didn't know about it. So, I mean, the administration has got to be ready if it has time. While it's not blowing up foreign countries and so on, it's got to be ready for Plan B in case the Supreme Court rejects this. They've got to try and force the useless Congress, Republican majority in Congress, to pass legislation. There is legislation in the Supreme Court, in the Congress on it. Mike Johnson just hasn't taken it up as usual.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, we have been going at this for 2 hours. I very much appreciate it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we should wrap up. So we should have a few final words. How do people follow your work besides peterbrillmo.com, which is your Substack?
Well, that is the way to follow me. But vdac.com itself is still up. And there are, we have hundreds of articles over 25 years that cover almost every aspect of this topic. I was delighted to see that Slobodian says we have 20,000 articles on white genocide. I just checked that a few moments ago, and I think it's 10,000, but it's still a lot. The search engine still works. I urge people to go in there and look at things. As I said earlier, my Substack is free, so I'm delighted when people sign up. If they feel like giving me money, that's always very welcome. But it is free at the moment. And, I have to say also, I'm sorry that we have Give, Send, Goals going, both for ourselves, Lydia, ourselves personally, because, of course, we've already paid a shocking amount of money to a personal lawyer. And, of course, for the VDEF Foundation is also having to pay lawyers. People are very generous. So if anybody feels like being generous to that, too, I'd appreciate it.
That's wonderful. Yeah. It's definitely worthwhile. And if people want to get on your mailing list for an upcoming conference or something, how can they do that? Can they do that through your Substack or through the...
Yes. Or my email there is, I'm editor at peterbrimlow.com. Just drop me a line. Mm-hmm. Or you could still like to Lydia, lbrimelow@vdare.com, because she's still on using her VDare email.
Well, let's not end on a totally dark note. You've actually, you're in the history books now, Peter, and I love the idea of you writing a memoir and setting all the records straight and telling these stories about people like Hayek and Rothbard and Friedman and so forth. You have interviewed a tremendous number of people. You've known a tremendous number of people. You've seen all kinds of changes happening in politics and society in your lifetime. I would love to read that. That's a great story.
So, well, I really appreciate that, Greg. Can I ask you, did you listen to my interview with Tucker Carlson?
I've only listened to chunks of it, but I thought it was excellent.
Well, because I told various stories there, mostly about Bill Buckley. But the whole transcript is up on peterbrimlow.com. And it's linked up, so various wild assertions I made are backed up in various ways.
That's great. Now, that was a real coup getting on Tucker, well-deserved. And so, folks, follow Peter at Substack and wherever he might also be. And we very much appreciate you out in the audience listening. And thank you, Peter, for joining us. I really have enjoyed this.
Thank you, Greg. And come to our conference if we can get it together.
Okay, I will try and make that work. So, folks, we will be back next week at the same time. I'm juggling a few possibilities as guests, but nobody has committed yet. And the world situation is changing so fast that we might regret setting anything in stone. So we will be back next week, though. And in the meantime, just keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you.